today on Against the Grain. Her fiction examines class divides, racial dynamics, and what makes and doesn't make it into our history books. Nina Revor's thought-provoking new novel is A Student of History. I'm CS, the Los Angeles-based writer, joins me, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Gaping inequalities of income and wealth have been explained and explored in many ways and in many genres. Nina Revor's genre is fiction. She's long been interested in how class plays out socially and politically, and her writing focuses as well on race and racism. Not surprising, perhaps, given that Revor is half Japanese, half Polish-American. The super-rich descendants of the founders of the city of Los Angeles are prominently featured in Nina Revor's new novel, her sixth. It's called A Student of History. In it, a struggling graduate student who comes from a blue-collar background gains access to elite social circles, the members of which, to him, might as well be from another planet. These are the incredibly wealthy people who live in places like Bel Air, people who exert tremendous influence behind the scenes over social and cultural policy. Nina Revor's other novels include The Necessary Hunger, Southland, and Wing Shooters. She's been a visiting professor at Cornell, Occidental College, Pitzer College, and Pomona College. When Nina joined me recently in studio, I asked what spurred her to write A Student of History.
There was a key incident that really helped me to formulate what I wanted to do in this book. And that occurred in 2011 during the height of the Occupy movement. I was in a downtown private club in Los Angeles. I was there for a lunch that was work-related. And this is one of those clubs that you have to be, you know, a member for, that the elite of the city, the folks who are very, very wealthy, often from generations of wealth, this is one of their playgrounds. And this lunch was happening at a time when there were protesters outside of City Hall. People were basically encamped in front of City Hall in Los Angeles, a couple blocks away, that were part of the Occupy movement. And a associate of mine, who herself, like me, does not come from privilege, wryly commented, well, those folks are protesting at the wrong place. They really should be marching here. And what she meant by that was that sometimes people almost inaccurately, or at least just, you know, not completely, assume that decisions, that power is expressed in places of government, in City Hall, in the state houses, in Congress, etc., when in fact a lot of the expressions of power, of influence, happen behind closed doors and happen in places like the club we were in, where people of influence and tremendous wealth often gather and often express that power well out of sight. And so I really wanted to think about, you know, the invisible aristocracy, the people who are almost behind the scenes, you know, making decisions, influencing policy that really, really affects us all. And then the other part of that, of course, is that, you know, I'm a writer who's really drawn to writing about history and the ways that historical events, you know, things that are centuries old or generations old, still have a bearing on present day events. And so in Los Angeles, that happens in the person of people who are the descendants of the founders of the city. You know, the oil barons, the real estate barons, the steel barons, the people who really helped to shape Los Angeles, and in Los Angeles terms, are old money. And the fact that some of those names, some of those people have descendants who are still in the city today, still influencing things today. And I thought that that was really interesting, because when you think about Los Angeles, you think about a really young place. You think about wealth in terms of Hollywood and entertainment, you know, or increasingly the tech industry. But there are these other sets of wealthy people who have much deeper roots, longer histories. And I thought that was really something interesting to play with.
So there's this super rich woman in her 70s. She is a scion of one of LA's wealthiest and oldest and most established families. What can you tell us about this woman? Her name is Marion.
Yes, Marion, and the last initial W, and she's known throughout the book by that initial as Mrs. W. Her last name is never revealed. And she is the granddaughter of one of the oil barons who really helped to shape the city. And she's an interesting and in some ways paradoxical character because on the one hand, you know, she's obviously extremely wealthy. She lives up on a hill, you know, kind of removed from the masses of Los Angeles. She also, you know, exercises her privilege in ways that are not always the best, you know, that she's trying to, you know, kind of defend what she has amassed, certainly sees herself as and is a part of a certain extremely exclusive club of people, and expresses views that are misanthropic, that are racist, you know, that do not reflect very well on her. You know, but at the same time that she does this, she's also almost secretly, almost despite herself, very generous, does things unexpectedly, you know, that seem to counter the things that come out of her mouth, and who essentially takes the main character, Rick Nagano, under her wing. You know, ostensibly she hires him as a research assistant, but she, you know, ultimately really becomes grateful for his companionship.
Rick is a struggling grad student in history at USC, and he's down on his luck. He's having a hard time working on his dissertation. What kind of contrast did you want to establish or convey between this woman whose journals, whose private handwritten journals he is hired to transcribe, and this grad student?
So Rick is in some sense an everyman. He is from a modest blue-collar background. Both his father and his grandfather are electricians. His grandfather was an immigrant from Japan. And so Rick is, you know, third-generation Japanese-American, mixed race, and grew up in the Crenshaw neighborhood, where my book Southland was also set a number of years ago, in a mixed African-American and Japanese-American neighborhood. He's the first in his family to go to college. And so, you know, when he finds this job working as a research assistant, he suddenly becomes exposed to Mrs. W. and her crowd. You know, obviously he's never had any contact with someone like this. And I really wanted to show that juxtaposition of someone who is, you know, the daily struggle to get by, whose family is of modest means, you know, in contrast to just the tremendous wealth and privilege of Mrs. W. and her set, and the fact that these things coexist, you know, in the same city. And I started writing this book, you know, some time ago, probably a decade ago. But in the time since I started it, of course, you know, this whole dynamic of income inequality has become even more pronounced. So that was the contrast that I wanted to show, and also to, you know, see the ways that the circles cross, and they cross in the place of USC, but also the ways that they are never going to be able to come together.
We could say that the lives and situations of these two characters are worlds apart. And I think you're masterful in the way you establish that via various details about her life and her social circles and where she hangs out and his. Could you share some of that, like this whole idea that there is such a difference in situation and perhaps attitude and consciousness between blue-collar folks and these incredibly wealthy people?
You know, this is something that I saw and witnessed and experienced a lot, even in my daily life. For many years, I worked for a nonprofit organization serving kids that are affected by violence and poverty in South and in Central Los Angeles. And we did everything from early childhood services to mental health to child welfare. And often, you know, even in the same day, I might travel from the housing developments in Watts, where we served a number of families, to a very, you know, exclusive, elite, expensive place in West LA, where many of the wealthy of Los Angeles live, for a meeting or for a fundraiser. And I couldn't believe that these worlds existed in the same city. And I felt, you know, on the one hand, really privileged in a way to be able to get to traverse the entirety of the city. But it also just struck me how extreme those extremes were and that those worlds don't really come together. And so that was something that I wanted to explore. And I think that one thing, on the one hand, obviously, you know, Rick, his challenges are still relative. He is still a graduate student at USC. You know, he is not a destitute guy who's facing homelessness the way that so many people are in Los Angeles today. He is, you know, the son and grandson of a working class family who's now going to, you know, went to Stanford, is now going to USC for graduate school. He's actually still doing okay. So I don't want to exaggerate his difficulties. But at the same time, he is struggling to make his monthly rent. You know, he sees the difference between himself and his college friends who are in tech or in entertainment who are making a lot of money. But I think that the wealth that's expressed by Mrs. W and her group is just so extreme. You know, and he talks about someone wearing some jewelry that's probably more than he makes in an entire year. He goes to events where, as an auction item, is a vacation at a private island. There are just things that are outside of the realm of normal experience for most people. And what happens then sometimes is that folks get a sense that money or access to money becomes the answer to everything. There's an exchange that Rick has with Mrs. W about two-thirds of the way through the book where she's offering to help him. And of course, part of privilege is not just about money, it's about access. But she says, you know, that she's essentially going to help him in something related to his studies because she's a donor of something. And he says to her, well, money can't solve everything. And she looks at him like he's crazy and says, well, of course it can.
Her name is Nina Revor. She is the author of 6 novels. Her new book is A Student of History. It's published by Akashic Books. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. What do you say in this novel about categories within the super wealthy, the way the wealthy choose to associate or not associate with other rich people, and on the basis of what do we learn about how perhaps wealth and the super rich are not as monolithic a group as we might think?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question because I think they're not as monolithic as you might think in a couple of ways. And the first is around the issue of, you know, wealth almost as distinct from class. You can be super wealthy, but with these folks, the inner circles are occupied not just by people who have massive amounts of money, but who descend from particular families. And so what Rick learns throughout his travels is that class is not just about money, but also about lineage. You know, the folks who are the more recent millionaires and billionaires, you know, the tech people, the entertainment people, don't register in the same way, at least in this particular world, than the folks who are second, third, fourth generation Angelenos who come from the original families. And that is a dynamic that, of course, is explored in other novels about class, you know, including The Great Gatsby, which is, you know, you've got the new money that's represented by what Jay Gatsby is able to achieve versus the old money is represented by the Buchanans. And those are totally different worlds. And I'd say that the other thing that was very important for me to capture, yeah, I'm really drawn to stories about class. Class, in some ways, is one of the great American topics. And at the same time, most stories about class also don't take race into account as a factor. And so it's significant in this case that Rick is not just a blue-collar kid who's the son and grandson of electricians, but that he's Japanese-American. And that in most of these circles that he's moving in, he is the only person of color in the room, or at least the only person of color who's not, you know, serving. And I wanted to play with that dynamic as well, you know, what that means for him, and also what he gives up or compromises in trying to gain access to this world.
Another major character in your book is a woman named Fiona, who Rick, the graduate student, gets to know. Fiona is much closer in age to Rick than is Mrs. W. What's Fiona's importance to your narrative?
Well, you have to have a love interest, or you have to have a love intrigue, of course. Or at least I do. That just makes it that much more fun. But Fiona is also an heiress. She's the descendant of another old Los Angeles family. As you said, she's around Rick's age. They meet at a museum event, and he is immediately taken with her. You know, she shows him attention. She's interested in his rather obscure dissertation. She invites him to lunch. And of course, he is absolutely flattered by her attentions. And so, you know, unlike Mrs. W., who's obviously, you know, much older than him, he has a different kind of dynamic with her. With Fiona, he gets drawn into this dynamic with this young woman who's quite appealing. And because sometimes when we're, you know, desire is not always the best basis on which to make some decisions. And so she engages him to essentially find out some information for her. And as you can imagine, some bad things ensue.
Right. And part of what happens there, and you've kind of referred to it, is Rick's kind of attraction to this class of people. I mean, he's very intrigued, and he certainly sees how he's a fish out of water, and he's extremely awkward. He doesn't even know where to put his hands or his legs sometimes when he's sitting with these people. But there is that attraction to people and their lifestyle, and of course, there's probably some envy wrapped up in there. At one point, Rick remembers his mother saying to him, and I think this was after his mother attended the Stanford graduation. So Rick went to Stanford for his bachelor's, and his parents were there, his working class parents were there. And she says to Rick, "You're too impressed with people whose greatest accomplishment was being born lucky." Can you comment on that? And do you think that statement by Rick's mother applies to people in the U.S. more generally?
I love that little exchange, and I love that whole little scene where, you know, Rick's going through his graduation at Stanford. He is frankly embarrassed by his parents, you know, who have taken time away from work, which is really difficult for them. His father is in a suit, I think, for the first or second time in his life. And all Rick can think about is just how, you know, bad this makes him look in front of, you know, the girls that he's trying to impress at that particular time, whose parents are fancier than his. And Rick's mother, who's just wonderful at cutting through BS, calls him on this. And I think that what that really gets to is that while Rick is, of course, you know, a fish out of water, the blue-collar kid in a world where he doesn't belong, he's also not blameless in this situation. And that was important to me because I didn't want him to just be some innocent knave who's taken advantage of by these rich ladies. It's much more interesting when you have a character who in some ways, you know, contributes to his own problems. I think that's just more complex. I think it's in some ways realistic. And I wanted him to, you know, go through that process of naively thinking, you know, gee, maybe I can become a part of Fiona's world. If I somehow shift my career focus or hang out with these people long enough or dress fancily enough because Mrs. W. is paying for my fancy clothes now, that somehow I'm going to merit the real attention of Fiona and her crowd. And of course, that's folly. So I think his mom is right in calling him out in that way. And to the second part of your question, I do believe that we are too interested as a society in folks who are born lucky and or who achieve a certain kind of notoriety in their lifetimes. And you think about that in terms of the fascination of all the reality shows about the housewives or the fabulously wealthy and the lifestyles of this and you know, why do we care about that? And you know, you think even in terms of folks not understanding how blue-collar white Americans largely could vote for a guy like Donald Trump and not resent his wealth. They don't resent it because there's a part of them that looks up to that and maybe wants to be that. And so I think there is this very complex relationship that we have with wealth where, you know, on the one hand, we resent it, and on the other, we envy it.
That's the voice of Nina Revoir, R-E-V-O-Y-R. She is the author of 6 novels, including The Age of Dreaming and Southland. Her 1997 novel, The Necessary Hunger, has just been reissued by Akashic Books with a new introduction by Lionel George and a new afterword by my guest. And her new novel is A Student of History, and it's also published by Akashic Books. My name is C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Details in novels are important, and so I thought quite a bit about the actual topic of the dissertation of this grad student who was the main character of this novel. Again, he's a Japanese-American. He lives in a working-class neighborhood. He goes to USC. He's struggling. He's something like, let's see, 2 chapters into his dissertation, but it's kind of stalled, and he really doesn't know what to do. What is the topic of the dissertation, and how might that relate to what's going on with his issues and dilemmas and adventures?
So the topic of his dissertation is something called Kenjinkai, which are essentially pooled funds that were created by Japanese immigrants and Japanese Americans to raise capital for things like businesses, investments, etc., when Japanese American communities could not get loans through traditional means like banks. And so, you know, some form of these continue in some communities to this day. And His own grandfather got a start in his business through the Kenjinkai loan. And these are often related to the prefecture that folks came from originally in Japan. So that's what he's talking about, is this kind of these pooled funds that people draw from in order to get started in whatever endeavor they have. And I think that he can't get really untracked on his dissertation for a couple of reasons. Well, maybe 3. You know, one is that he starts the book in the doldrums because he's gone through a breakup and he's in a little bit of a funk and he just kind of can't seem to get out of it. So there's the personal part of it. But the more thematic part of it, I think there's 2 parts. One is that the Kenjinkai is a very concrete example of community. It's a very concrete example of folks participating in something that is bigger than them and that is a collective. And that's something that's really represented by the community his family grew up in, the Crenshaw District, which is a magical place, which, as you know, I've written about before, a kind of organically mixed race place where you had Japanese Americans, African Americans, whites as well, often immigrants, who all lived together in relative peace, you know, 20s, 30s, 40s, Los Angeles, until, well, the internment disrupted it, but people came back. And, you know, even through the 60s, you would see high school yearbooks that were about a third black, a third Japanese, and a third white. But it was a place where people were able to both embrace their individual and group identities, but also to identify with a community that was larger than them. And I think a pretty magical place. And in some ways, Rick is spending his life trying to get away from his background. You know, not necessarily getting away from his race, but certainly getting away from his class, getting away from, you know, all the things that made him. And so maybe there's some cognitive dissonance or some inability because ultimately he, you know, he shouldn't do that. He can't do that. And I think the second part of the thematic issue is that he's having some difficulty really grappling with history. He's a history student. He's in the history department. But he says at some point, you know, who was he to write about history? Who was he to determine, you know, when there's an end to the narrative, when you can say this is done and therefore I can write about it? You know, and he uses the analogy of pinning a butterfly, you know, to a box when it's still wriggling and alive. And so he has some hesitation in doing that, which ultimately is probably a good hesitation, because one of the things that he learns in his interactions with Mrs. W. and her crowd is that so much of history happens outside of view. It doesn't make it into the history books. He's not even aware of it, and other people aren't either. And so the whole kind of question of the study of history is, you know, is doubtful. And so I think that's why he has some struggles with his dissertation.
He investigates partly on his own interest and also at the behest of Fiona, this friend he makes. He investigates something that really is important to the book, and we're not going to spoil it for listeners. But he does find a certain kind of fascination and interest in investigating the issue. And I think he makes a certain comparison between investigating something that's kind of current day or recent history and kind of doing that maybe more dull historical work of, you know, decades and centuries past. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So Fiona enlists him in trying to find something out about someone else in their circle. And he is, of course, a skilled researcher. And so he is able to do so. And he does make a comment about how it just feels more relevant to be able to look into something that seems to be more present day, that seems to have a bearing on current events and current people. But I think the other thing that he finds through the course of doing this is that the gilded, privileged, unreachable world of the wealthy that he's entered is not so perfect as it seems. And that even people who appear to have everything going for them and who appear to have every advantage are grappling with loss, are grappling with grief, are conflicted about decisions, and that all the wealth in the world cannot protect them from the human condition and from sorrow. And so, you know, on the one hand, he enjoys going off to run this errand for Fiona, which sends him off to the central coast of California. But on the other hand, what he uncovers is both the answer to the particular question that he was seeking, but also layers and layers beyond that, almost about the mystery of the human condition.
Nina Revor, she joins me in studio, and her sixth novel, her new novel, is A Student of History. We'll take a short break and speak more with Nina. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Nina Revor has written six novels, and her latest one, her new one, is called A Student of History. It's published by Akashic Books. And again, it's about a blue-collar Japanese-American struggling grad student. His department is history at USC, and the way he latches on to, because he gets employed by a super rich woman who's part of one of the oldest families in LA, and she has engaged him to transcribe, to type out her handwritten journals, and he gets into a number of adventures with and in relation to her. What kind of research did you do into the kind of super wealthy old moneyed families of LA, and also into Los Angeles's early history?
I did quite a bit. And Mulholland, his story is quite famous. He's the person who engineered the building of the aqueduct that took water essentially from the Owens Valley and brought it to Los Angeles, which is what enabled LA to grow in the early 20th century, immortalized fictionally in the movie Chinatown. And then I mentioned also Edward Doheny, who was an early oil baron and probably the basis of the novel Oil, which then became the movie, or was the basis of the movie There Will Be Blood. But part of what was fun for me in going back to research those characters and others is how many stories there were like that. you know, people who came out from the Midwest or the East Coast or from Europe and made their way to Los Angeles and often did these very unglamorous things, whether it was digging for oil or kind of doing manual labor in order to create ways for railroads. And of course, these were all highly problematic things. You know, some were problematic than others. Some people didn't necessarily know were problematic, you know, like oil extraction. But that these folks came out and, you know, through dint of muscle and will, were able to extract fortunes from Los Angeles. And then the boosters picked up and started talking about how wonderful the weather was. And then you have pictures of orange trees, and that starts to lead to the development of a city. And it was just fascinating to read not only a number of biographies of early people, but then, you know, daily journals or descriptions of what it was like to grow up in Los Angeles. It's completely unrecognizable to me, you know, that was rural, that was filled with fields, and that in some cases, it actually hasn't been that long since it's changed. Something that I learned much more recently after I'd actually finished or nearly finished the book was that all of Malibu, which I flew over today to get here, used to belong to one family. And they had gates essentially at either end of it along the coast and would not allow access to people trying to get in. And again, this was well into the 20th century. That was fascinating to me. Mm-hmm. And so to read about those histories and the struggles to, you know, make land accessible, or, you know, the downtown Los Angeles used to be covered with oil derricks, you know, or the creation of a place like Beverly Hills or Bel Air or Palos Verdes, and, you know, places that are still so exclusive today, that was very fun to read and sometimes really disturbing as well.
Yeah, your main character, Rick, when he visits the central coast of California, he's looking at this beautiful landscape and he's wondering, how did this come to be privately owned? Like, it doesn't make sense for one person or one family to have exclusive ownership of this incredible area.
Yes, exactly. And I was thinking about that this morning as we flew up over the Big Sur coast and just how incredibly beautiful it is, how untouched so much of it still is. And part of the fun for me, I've never written about the Central Coast. I've written about the natural world in other books, but in the mountains, most recently in my last book, The Sierras, but not the Central Coast. And it was so fun to write about, you know, the interplay of the mountains and the ocean and the fog, and also the juxtaposition of how fragile and how temporary we are as human beings versus the long-standing kind of stature of nature, and that we can't compete, or at least I hope we can't. You know, that despite our best efforts as human beings to, you know, hurt our environment, nature always wins. And in some ways, well, in many ways, I hope that continues. But that was part of what I was really trying to get at, that even these wealthy people, incredibly privileged, influential people, cannot exert their will over a natural world that's always going to last longer than them.
We've been talking about some pretty weighty themes, but there's a lot of fun in this novel. There's a lot of suspense. There is humor. How important was it for you to make this not just an interesting read, but a pleasurable read?
Always my first concern in writing novels is to make them books that people want to read. And I do think that entertaining the reader, bringing the reader along, is first and foremost the most important thing I can do as a writer. Not in spite of, but because I write about weighty issues. I usually write about race and class. I often write about community and history. And it's important to do so, I believe, in a compelling way that will make people come along almost even despite themselves. So I always try to make the story, the characters, you know, interesting. In this case especially, I wanted to make the book fun. It was tremendous fun to write. And that is both in terms of, you know, while on the one hand, it's very easy to see this book as a critique of a certain class of people, a certain kind of people, it's also, as many of my other books have been, a love letter to Los Angeles. You know, you get the landscape of Los Angeles, you get different parts of Los Angeles, whether it's Bel Air or South Los Angeles or Crenshaw or Westchester, where Rick grows up. So there is that aspect of wanting to draw that place again. but in addition to draw it with humor. You know, starting from his very first interaction with Mrs. W, she's also really funny. And his interactions with him are funny because he is so awkward. You know, you mentioned he never knows what to do, you know, whether to kiss someone on the cheek or do an air kiss. How do you react when someone compliments you? He just has no idea how to function in this world. And it just goes from there. So, you know, I wanted to make her entertaining. I wanted to make their interaction fun. I wanted to make the whole book fun.
You grew up in Tokyo, and you lived there till age 5. Then you moved to Wisconsin with your family till age 9. And then your family and you moved to Los Angeles. When, Nina, did you realize that you loved LA or that you were drawn to it in a special way?
You know, I think the short answer is when I left it. And, you know, often we don't appreciate something, family, love, a place, until we leave it or until it's somehow under threat of being lost. And so for me, it took probably leaving to go off to the East Coast for college. And then I went back to Japan and lived for a few years. Then I went back east again for grad school. And I had a stint in LA in between. But there was something about that distance that both created a certain kind of longing. It's really important for me as a writer to feel that sense of longing. And then I think also that it gave me a perspective that I didn't have when I was still in the place. You know, to give a very concrete example, I didn't realize that my upbringing in Los Angeles, where my high school was incredibly diverse, you know, where we had something like 47 languages spoken, where it was probably equally Black, Latino, Asian, and white, I didn't realize that was unusual until I went off to the East Coast for college. I didn't notice that we had mountains ringing Los Angeles until I went off somewhere and didn't have them. And so that appreciation, that clear sight, and that longing and missing LA is part of what led to my wanting to write about it. And so I actually wrote most of my first book, The Necessary Hunger, which was just reissued, as you mentioned, when I was living in Japan and then in upstate New York. And I wrote most of my second book, which is Southland, and probably the most Los Angeles of my Los Angeles books. I wrote that largely when I was in upstate New York. So it took that absence. And then for a long time, I couldn't write about Los Angeles when I was in it. And that probably contributes to why my books were set in the past. Southland, you know, was largely set in the 30s, 40s, 50s leading up to the 60s. The Age of Dreaming, which is set in the silent film era, set in the 1920s largely, and then some in the 60s. And it wasn't really, and then my next book was in Wisconsin. So it wasn't really until my last book, Lost Canyon, that I set a book in contemporary Los Angeles. And even most of that was in the Sierras. So in some ways, I'm just realizing as I'm saying it, A Student of History is probably my first contemporary Los Angeles book that's set so, oh, and even that's not fully in Los Angeles because part of it's the Central Coast. Mm. But I've finally learned to write about LA when I'm living in it.
The writer Nina Revoir joins me in studio. Again, it's R-E-V-O-Y-R, and her sixth and latest novel is A Student of History. I'm C.S., and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So the schools you attended in LA might have been diverse, and that might have felt comfortable to you, and you might have gotten used to it, and yet, you know, you are Japanese-American, you're biracial. You grew up in Tokyo, where I imagine mixed-race people, there are certain attitudes towards mixed-race people. You moved to Wisconsin at an early age, and I think I read somewhere that that wasn't the most comfortable place for you in terms of your either racial identity or feeling accepted because of who you are, who you were ethnically, racially. So can you talk about that? Like, what was it like growing up not fully Japanese in Japan and not fully white in the U.S. in the heartland in the Midwest?
Well, that's a great question. And I think that in a lot of ways, that kind of place of not being, of not belonging, of being an outsider, really, really fed into my becoming a writer. Being an outsider is a very useful place to be as a novelist because you can observe, and you can also, you know, empathize. When you have one foot in one world and another foot always outside of it, there's this sense of being other but also part of that's just, it's a weird place to sit as a human being, but I think a good place to be as a writer, because you always have a certain perspective. So I left Japan when I was 5. And, you know, I remember going to both a Japanese school. I think I went to a Japanese school in the kind of midday, and then to an quote, international school, which were all expatriates, in the morning, and didn't feel quite comfortable in either place. But my family was in Japan, my mother, my grandmother, you know, my uncle, my cousins. And then we moved, as you said, not just to the Midwest and Wisconsin, but to a small town there where I was, you know, as you can imagine, the only immigrant, I think the only person of color, and then was living with my white blue-collar grandparents. And that was a really, really difficult place to be. Certainly taught me a lot and shaped my views about immigration, about race in the United States, etc. And it wasn't really until we moved to California when I was 9 that I felt comfortable, you know, that just even physically kind of fitting in, because we have such a polyglot of people in Los Angeles. One of the things that was interesting, though, about returning to Wisconsin in 2011, when my novel Wing Shooters, which is set there, came out in 2011. So I went back to Wisconsin for the first time in 27 years. And it was amazing to me how familiar it felt. And also, it was amazing to realize how much of the experience of living in Wisconsin for 4 years and then going back there every summer until I was 14 shaped me. You know, everything from work ethic to, you know, a real discomfort with display, you know, a real valuing of modesty and of carrying yourself in a certain way in the world. And of course, that probably, you know, comes from the Japanese side as well. But when I got back in touch with Wisconsin, some of my relatives there, I saw a lot of that. And I saw the ways that that world had shaped me also, and was grateful for all of these very different ingredients that went into the making of who I am.
So as I mentioned earlier, your debut novel, The Necessary Hunger, has just been reissued by Akashic Books. It was published in 1997. That was 22 years ago. And I wonder, how has your writing process changed, if at all, over the course of writing 6 novels over more than 2 decades?
The process, I'm not sure the process has changed so much. You know, I'm still, just to be boringly tactical, a morning writer. I still need, you know, absolute quiet and lack of distraction. And that often means putting myself in a place where I don't have internet, I don't have cell phone and all of that. So those things have not changed. I think what has changed is that as you grow up, frankly, you know, and enter middle age, life becomes busier. You know, you have more obligation, you have more responsibility. My first book and much of my second book I wrote when I had a more flexible schedule. But since then, I've always had a full-time day job and have sometimes taught on top of that. And so just the, you know, the work of making the time to write is difficult, but the actual process is probably not as difficult or not as different, if that makes sense. And also, and this is less about process and more about subject matter or who I am as a writer. I recently read my first novel, The Necessary Hunger, for the first time in the 22 years since it was published. And it is, to say the least, a strange experience, a jarring experience to enter your own head from 22 years ago. And that was quite something. And it also showed me both the astonishing ways in which the world has changed since 1997 and the ways that my own life has changed, but also the ways in which it hasn't. And to be specific, in 1997, when The Necessary Hunger came out, so the protagonists are all these baby queers. They're basketball players, and it's around a group of Asian American and African American girls basketball players growing up in Inglewood. In 1997, to have a lesbian protagonist in a book published by a major press was news. It was a big deal. 1997 was the year that Ellen had her coming out episode. It was a year after the WNBA started and when it was still really uncomfortable with the fact that so many of its fans and players were queer. It was a time when it was still not entirely acceptable for people to be out. And to go from 1997 and how radical that book seemed at the time to just how blasé queer issues are at this time, it's really a wonderful, wonderful change. I couldn't have imagined that the world would change so drastically in that time. And another thing that has changed is, you know, my own trajectory. You know, and like Rick, I come from a modest background and also then went to some fancy schools that on the one hand, you know, kind of catapulted me into a different socioeconomic class, but in a, you know, on another hand, does not change where you come from. And I think, unlike Rick, I'm much more comfortable with my class background, very proud of my class background. But another thing that has not changed since 1997, you know, the book was published in 97, it's set in the mid-80s, and this was pre-civil unrest of 1992. And so the challenges of the kids in that novel, living in Inglewood in South Los Angeles, dealing with violence and poverty, dealing with racism, we have made astonishingly little progress in those subject areas in those neighborhoods in Los Angeles.
So you have taught, you've been a visiting professor at Cornell, at Occidental College, at Pitzer College, at Pomona College. I think you've co-edited some kind of a textbook on reading and writing. And I wonder, as you have learned more about writing and the art of writing, the technique of writing, whether as you write and as you've progressed over the years, you think more as you write about, you know, what am I doing? What am I pushing for? What kinds of techniques do I want to bring to bear? How might this be analyzed after it's published?
I've tried very hard not to let it. I have exercised a kind of, when I write, I exercise a kind of willful forgetting of issues of technique, you know, of theme, of implication, et cetera. And of course, it doesn't mean that it's not there. It's more like I'm in a bubble and it's floating outside and I try not to let it in. You know, there's the creative mind and then there's the critical mind. And so when I'm actually writing and producing, I'm trying to let the creative mind do its thing with the hope and understanding that I've done this now enough that I can, you know, can do some things, but at the same time not overthinking, oh, what does this paragraph or this image imply? What happens, you know, thematically if this happens here? That I will figure out later when I go back and read it with my critical mind. And I think of something like a baseball swing. Think about hitters who are really good hitters and how sometimes they get into a hitting slump. Sometimes that can happen if you're overthinking, if you are thinking about the mechanics of where your foot is or where your hip is or how or when your shoulders fly open or, you know, the way that your wrists are in position to your elbow, et cetera. All those things are important. But if you are thinking about that during the process of your swing, you're probably going to screw up your swing. And so there's the time when you're paying attention to the mechanics, but then there's the time when you have to go out and just hit the ball. And so I try to just go out and hit the ball and then go back and think about the mechanics.
Mrs. W's grandfather, so he was generous and very kind and good to his workers. I mean, he hung out with them. He sometimes would pick up a shovel and do things even though he was the boss. But he grew up poor. And so unlike his heirs, he lived a very modest lifestyle before becoming extremely rich. Do you think that might have affected the way he saw class and the way he understood people outside of his own class?
Absolutely. He is someone who himself struggled and therefore identified with the struggles of other people. And I think that can kind of go to one of two ways when someone is self-made the way that Langley W. was. You can still identify with where you came from, as he did, or you can completely disassociate yourself from where you came from, as other people do. But I think that you also hit on something that is really important to me, that it's not money or wealth in itself, I think, that is necessarily, you know, the great problem. And I mean that as a novelist and also as a human, because it would be so easy and frankly just reductive and not that interesting if I were simply to write, you know, all rich people are bad. That would be as simplistic as saying all low-income people are, you know, virtuous. Like it's there are complexities in human personality across the board. So I don't see Mrs. W's or Fiona's or the other characters, I don't see the problem necessarily or the only problem as their wealth. I see the issue, I see the real problem is when people make money their master, which is a slightly different thing. That you can be wealthy and still care about things outside of yourself. You can still, you know, contribute to causes, do work, be kind, as Langley W. was. Or you can spend your whole life concentrating on the amassing of, the expenditure of, the defense of your wealth, and that becomes the most important thing. And so that's really the critique of Fiona, especially, and her set, is what their wealth and what their status means to them. And Rick, in some ways, is hit with the same bug, where he somehow thinks, he's blue collar, but he somehow thinks that the gaining of money is going to not just solve his problems, but make him a different kind of person. And so that's what I was trying to get at. And I think that Langley, you know, of course, Langley is also not beyond critique, because he was part of a, you know, a set of people who started, you know, an extractive industry, which, you know, ultimately a century later is destroying our planet, to put it mildly, you know, climate, water. So which, of course, no one necessarily knew at the time. But, you know, it's not like he was faultless either. But yet he did have a different relationship to his wealth and to people that seemed to be different than him than his descendants do. And I also think that one of the problems, I don't think that wealth necessarily automatically makes people bad. But what it can do, and what it too often does, is that it removes people from the problems and challenges of everyday life. And because of that, it then makes it really difficult when folks of money have influence, when they don't really understand what it's like to struggle for rent, you know, or to not have a grocery store nearby, or to live in such a toxic place because there's oil drilling or, you know, some kind of toxic waste where you are that your children get asthma. And so it's that removal that can also be a real detriment and can lead to all kinds of bad things.
Nina Revor, her new novel is A Student of History. It's published by Akashic Books, which has also reissued her debut 1997 novel, The Necessary Hunger. Nina, thanks so much for your work. I really enjoyed this novel, and thank you for joining me in studio.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.